accession number 23329, reel 13.
Carl Junger, reel 13.
I said to the Gestapo, D9 was the epitome of the mad dogs and Englishmen tradition. I'll give you the reason in a moment. We were not usually warned in advance of searches to be carried out by camp security men. Usually you came back to your barrack after parade and you couldn't get in. There was a search taking place. The Gestapo was a different matter. Our German guards quietly warned us of an impending raid by the Gestapo. And that was because it was aimed as much at them as it was at us. The Gestapo wanted to ferret out any evidence of bribery, for instance, or even commerce with the guards. The first time that we experienced a Gestapo search was in October 1943. And from the windows, we watched them turn into the road between D block and C block. They were straight out of the cinema, mostly in black, jack-booted, black felt-hatted. Some wore green breeches and black coats, and a few ordinary lounge suits, but mostly they were the typical all-black type. They seemed to be either rather large, bullocky types or little sharp-witted, weaselly types. We hadn't had our breakfast when we were ordered from the barracks, and this time the room leaders, who customarily remained during searches by the Abwehr, were not allowed to remain. Herded onto the parade ground, and guards, who were normally fairly inoffensive, put on a great act, scowling and threatening to impress the Gestapo. We tried to make ourselves inconspicuous by silence, and they tried to achieve the same end by being as arrogant and noisy and bullying as they could. It was a chilly morning, a strong chilly breeze. We were stripped naked, and I was a bit lucky because when I was half undressed, I pretended I was dressing, and as if I had been searched. A few people casually sauntered to join those who'd been done and escaped the indignity altogether. Ron Buchanan tried this on, but he was too big a man to go unnoticed, and the Gestapo man, bigger even than he, began to manhandle him. Buck, as we called him, was slow to anger, but this time he almost lost control, and he was just about to strike the Gestapo man when we somehow grabbed his arm and hustled him away. had the impression that the Gestapo man really wanted Buck to hit him, but having been thwarted in that, he seemed to forget why he'd singled out the Australian in the first place, and just contented himself with a few threatening words. Didn't make any attempt to go after him. When we returned to the room, it was to find that a great deal of damage had been done. There had been deliberate wrecking. Went far beyond just tossing away articles to get at something underneath them. And many of our ordinary possessions had been looted, something that rarely happened with the normal Advia ferrets. There were sacks and sacks of our possessions, including some that we shouldn't have had, admittedly, standing outside the doors. And the Gestapo men, not paying much attention to them, never dreaming that the prisoners would have the audacity to thieve some of the stuff back again. But that's what happened. Whole sacks disappeared while the Gestapo men were distracted in one way or another. One chap very obsequiously asked for autographs. It wasn't only our own property that we got back. The torches and various tools belonging to the Gestapo were pinched from them. And there was no complaint. We could only assume that the Gestapo would feel humiliated if it came to be known that they'd been taken for a ride in that way. There were various booby traps laid for them too, and mostly in D9. Ken Bowden had managed schoolboy stuff like sacks of flour above the door. Probably wasn't flour, I expect it was milk powder. The Gestapo found a tin containing dissected frogs and mice in formalin, and that was labelled "Food, don't touch." And then there was a wall clock, which was worked by a gramophone spring, which had worn out on one side and was now working satisfactorily on the other. The hands went anti-clockwise and the figures had been reversed. And an anti-clockwise clock summed up Kriegi life. But it was all the Gestapo needed to convince them that D9 was the hut where the camp lunatics were housed. First arrived at Heiderkrug. We had a German dentist. The surgery was primitive, just a kitchen chair with a bucket beside it. And the drill was operated by pedals like an old sewing machine. The peddler was a fellow Kriegi volunteer, and it was a pretty boring job, so sometimes the peddler would start thinking of something else, and he'd go slower and slower, and the drill went slower and slower in your mouth, and it seemed then that you had a rasp in your mouth. And the the dentist appealed for somebody with experience as a dental mechanic, and Charlie Dare, a New Zealander, stepped forward, and shortly afterwards the German dentist invited him to have a go with the drill, and so he bored at somebody's tooth, and the dentist said, "You're doing it very well, carry on." And that was the last we saw of him. Dare found himself the dentist for a camp of 5,000 men, not to mention Russians from outside, who were queued up to have teeth extracted by a tyro dentist with no anaesthetic. Charlie Dare began to study dentistry in the evenings, and learning from his mistakes, became a very proficient dentist. Eventually, Captain Harries, a qualified dentist, army type, was posted to the camp, and there was more than enough work for them both. Most of the doctors we had, and dentists, when we had them, were army men. I can't recall any RAF doctors. I think the army ones mostly were taken at Dunkirk. But there were cases, I was told, of some doctors, and certainly some priests, being parachuted in with German permission to work in the camps. We had been expecting the invasion, the Second Front, as it was known then, to take place in the spring of 1943. Like many other people, including Stalin, we were a year out on that. But we reckoned that in Africa the tide had turned. The Nazis had had terrible losses at Stalingrad. And although the Dieppe raid had failed, we saw it as a reconnaissance mission that portended much more. About the spring passed and the summer, and so our strategist reckoned that autumn was the time, and then the troops would dig in for the winter. While our bombers, because I can't think of another, grated the concentrating Germans. And of course the Russians would roll forward, as invariably they did during the winter months. And the spring would come and there'd be a devastating push by our troops. And we should be home by the middle of 1944. That was our strategist. Well, we saw the coming of the winter snows, and our only hope now was a chap named Nobby Clark, who claimed to be a spiritualist and was in demand for evening lectures in the rooms. And he told us that recent conversations with informed spirits had enabled him to give December the 22nd as the date of the invasion, but he was also a logician, and he realized that the spirits had erred and the correct date was December the 23rd. Some thought Nobby was a leg puller, and but most believed that he was completely round the bend. He hadn't long been a prisoner. And clever old Nobby went before the repatriation board, was diagnosed as having acute melancholia, and home he went. Apparently his melancholia vanished the moment he was safely aboard the Red Cross ship. It was a little disillusioning when neither of Nobby's dates proved to be reliable, and people then forgot that in preparations for Christmas. The cookhouse offered to bake cakes for us. I can't remember what they were going to use. It must have been ground up biscuits from Canadian parcels, and there'd be raisins and things, but on the other hand the raisins were being put into other uses. There were barrels hidden under the floorboards, or buckets, nicely fermenting, ready for Christmas. The Germans then announced that any illicit brews found hidden would be confiscated. So we took that to mean that if we left them in the open, they wouldn't be seen. Well, the best brews had been made months before. The barrels, I can't remember where they came from, but I expect they'd been bribed or paid for in cigarettes. They were sealed with tar melted from the roof covering and buried, and every room was smelling of fermenting raisins, prunes, barleys, or potatoes. And the Germans carried out a search, and it was rather like the way one pretends to look for something hidden by a child. The guards investigated the most unlikely places and went away expressing satisfaction. And they returned then in an unofficial capacity to taste the brew. Having indulged in a number of other rooms, the Germans retired from the compound, a very merry band of prison guards. Actually, until this point, any alcohol found on the premises had always been poured away. We never knew why the latitude on this occasion, but it's unlikely that the commandant himself was aware of it, for he issued every man with a bottle of sarsaparilla masquerading as beer. And in seasonable humour, the commandant also gave Dixie Deans a large parcel and a letter he'd received with it. The letter, the letter was signed by Henry J. Harding, Secretary of the Lancashire Penny Fund. It was written in German, but it ran, "Dear Herr Kommandant, we are sending you this parcel of Christmas crackers in the hope that you will, with the assistance of the British man of confidence, distribute them to British POWs under your protection, so that some of them at least will enjoy a truly English Christmas. You will understand, no doubt, that owing to the shortage of paper and other materials resulting from the war, we are unable to make up individual parcels. And as in any case, we do not know the names of many of the prisoners, We are convinced that the distribution of these few crackers that we've been able to get together can be made only through your good offices and those of the man of confidence. We take this opportunity to express the hope that the war will end before next Christmas, so that all prisoners of war, British and German, may spend the festival of goodwill at home with their families. We wish you and your staff a happy Christmas. Dixie thanked the commandant, who was very impressed by the letter. Dixie was somewhat bewildered. He was sure that there was more here than met the eye. And when the crackers were pulled, what did meet the eye was German money, maps, and information calculated to assist escapers. We converted one corner of the room into a bar that Christmas night, and one or two of the boys dressed up as barmaids, and it was a very muddy olive-coloured brew and deceptively innocent-looking. Most of us ended up thoroughly inebriated. It was my first time. One thing that bothered me in the morning was remembering that I had kissed one of the barmaids and even enjoyed the forgotten taste of lipstick. But I wondered whether that I might have homosexual tendencies, something that had never occurred to me before. It's a question that people have asked a lot about, and sometimes I'm asked directly, sometimes it's rather circuitous probing. But I have to tell inquirers that I never knew of a case of homosexuality in Germany, and I never even heard the rumour of one. Often my answer is greeted with some scepticism. There were probably, in fact, I know there were some homosexuals among us, but it must be remembered that you couldn't turn the page of a book without somebody seeing you do it. And any moment of the night, in every room, half a dozen cigarettes were always alight. Life in the prison camp meant the abandonment of many inhibitions, but I think the moral code was observed more rather than less. Stealing, for instance, was a more despicable crime than in ordinary life, because it meant stealing from comrades, and because there being nothing to stop him from stealing, no kind of police force, for instance, every man, in a sense, was on his honour. Winter became more bitter. Every day, temperatures were well below freezing, even as late as the end of March, 1944, that was, was an epidemic of influenza, and the sick bay was soon crowded, and every barrack room had half a dozen or more men confined to bed. I went down with it myself, and in a way that was a good thing, because I received at that time the dreaded mess pot. I can't remember if I have mentioned earlier on that mess pot was a word that was used in the regular RAF, because when RAF men served in Mesopotamia before the war, many of them received Dear John letters, and they called them mess pots. Well, I received mine, and I was pretty miserable about it, obviously, but the flu allowed me to camouflage my misery, and only Dick knew about it, and he was very supportive. So he decided that he would teach me skating. I'd helped to build the ice rink. We dug out an area of ground just a few inches deep, and then with buckets and jugs, all kinds of containers, we filled it with water, and of course it froze at once in those temperatures. Literally hundreds of men had worked on it. My debut as a skater surprised other friends of mine, because I'd been more or less hibernating. In fact, one of them said to me, "I thought you'd gone home." Anyway, I had my first lesson, and most of it, I think, I spent being propped up by Dick and Toby. And after that, I collected my books and hurried to a classroom where I was to have a lecture by Mike Custance on Jeremy Bentham. I was doing an Oxford diploma, and Mike Custance, who was an Oxford man, was a tutor. He was a very brilliant man, and an authority on music, and he had a great appreciation of all the arts, really. And I have regarded as one of the highlights of my time in Germany a beautifully composed lecture on the art of criticism. Lectures by Mike and people like him were, for me, one of the most important aspects of life in the camp. I learned so much from those people. And during Mike's lecture on Bentham, a bullet crashed through the wall, and we heard the rattle of a machine gun outside. So we all raced out, and it turned out that somebody had gone too near the warning wire, and the guard, the postern in the box, had opened fire. Well, the Kriegi ran for it, found himself on the ice rink travelling at about 20 miles an hour in a sitting position. the trigger-happy postern directed his fire onto the crowded rink. The bullets ricocheted off the ice in all directions, and soon everybody was sliding across the ice on their backs. When the firing stopped, a number of Kriegies found that bullets had gone through the slack of their clothing, but nobody had suffered even a weal from the bullets. Skating was resumed, and we returned to the classroom, and customs continued from the point where he'd left off.